Right now, I'd like to invite James North up to the stage here to discuss a very important topic, the media, the mainstream media, which even though its numbers and readership may be declining a little bit, it's still very influential. So we all know that journalists, like everyone else, they have some of their biases and they manifest themselves one way or another. But the question is, are there more than sort of inadvertent biases in the media? Is there some sort of a systematic attempt in newsrooms to, not divulge the true truth of what is happening in Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East? And that's the question James North is here to discuss today, using the New York Times as a case study. James North is an independent writer based in New York City who has been reporting from Africa, Latin America, and Asia for 44 years. Many of you probably recognize him from his current gig as a contributing editor at Mondo Weiss. And over the years, he has written for The Nation, In These Times, and many other publications. And he's also the author of the book Freedom Rising, which provided a firsthand look at apartheid South Africa. He will discuss how the New York Times rigs news on Israel-Palestine. James North.
Please forgive me, I'm going to be shuffling papers around up here. I'm very careful to document what I say, and I've got the documentation here. So I'm here because I contribute to Mondo Weiss. Phil Weiss and I went to college together a long time ago, and we maintained our friendship, and we found, among other things, that we shared a view of Israel-Palestine over the years. And so when Phil decided to start working on this issue through Mondo Weiss, I believe it's 12 years ago now, I decided to help him to some extent. Phil is a person of extraordinary energy. It's just phenomenal how much he's able to write and stay abreast of this. And after a few years, he was joined by Adam Horowitz. They co-manage the site, another person with tremendous energy. The site has grown, Mondo Weiss has grown, and we maintain correspondence in Palestine, in Israel, and so it's comprehensive coverage. So if you're not already visiting Mondo Weiss, I would encourage you to do so. Let me just start by saying that although I've spent most of my career contributing to the alternative media, I am not prejudiced against foreign correspondents for the bigger papers automatically. I have had friends who were excellent correspondents at the New York Times and elsewhere. It's not as though I have anything against them. For instance, to just give one recent example, the Times correspondent in Egypt who covered the uprising there in 2011 and onwards, David Kirkpatrick, did what I regard as excellent coverage and an excellent book called Into the Hands of the Generals, which includes, interestingly enough, some information about how U.S. Desire to coddle up to Israel affected our policy toward Egypt. So I'm not automatically opposed to foreign correspondence for mainstream papers. However, the Times, is still such an important, it's still vital because, or maybe in some ways even more vital than ever. I mean, most of us in this room are familiar with alternative media, starting with the Washington Report, Mondo Weiss, Electronic Intifada, but we had to be aware that these outlets existed before we would go to them. We didn't simply stumble across them online. Certainly, the internet has made our work in communicating the truth about Israel-Palestine much easier to do, but it's not made it, your average person taking a train down from, say, Westchester into New York is going to be opening their copy of the New York Times every day, and the news that they're going to be reading is what's in that paper. They're not necessarily going to come to our sites yet, although alternative sites are growing. What's also important is that, as I say in the slide, other media have closed their foreign bureaus. I mean, up until 10 years ago, the LA Times had someone there, the Chicago Tribune, the Boston Globe, and these were alternate. I mean, the coverage wasn't necessarily outstanding, but there were different voices here. Now what happens is the Times is the main place that covers Israel-Palestine, and that people are increasingly, if you don't go to alternate sites, that's what you're gonna have to rely on. The Times is vital, again, because these alternate media is not totally, people are not totally aware of them. And so what I've done over the past 10 years is I've come up with various ways in which the Times is able to rig its coverage. I'm not saying there's a conspiracy here. I honestly don't think there's a conspiracy, but there's a way of doing business at the Times in which they try and minimize Israel's culpability in what goes on and try and maximize Palestinians. And I don't even think half the time they're even aware of this. And so what I'm gonna do is, if I have time, I'm gonna go through some of the ways in which we have discovered that this policy actually works. None of this will be a surprise to many of you, but maybe the systematic nature might impact you. First, you know, there's nothing better than a little good old-fashioned Orientalism. Trying to treat Muslims and Arabs as though they're a different sort of human being who operate under different assumptions and are motivated in different ways. And the Times still relies on this to some extent. Again, I think this is unconscious, but I'm just gonna give you, good old-fashioned Orientalism, you know, centuries old. Okay, this is from a news analysis that appeared a couple of years ago. And as you can see, I quote a paragraph here from Stephen Erlanger, who's a veteran reporter, and then I'll tell you what I think is going on here. Here's the paragraph. Unlike Fatah, Hamas claims the whole of the British Mandate of Palestine is land granted by Allah, which cannot be ceded. In other words, Israel is illegitimate and its occupants should, quote, go home. The most any senior Hamas official ever offered was a hudna, a ceasefire, which the Prophet Muhammad offered enemies to restore his strength. Now, this is a classic Orientalist gem. Let's start with not translating Allah to God. I mean, this is very commonly done, and not just by the Times. Just imagine if every time you read a story from France where God was mentioned, if it said Dieu, or every time a Spanish person in your newspaper talked about God, it was put in Dios. I mean, this is why some Americans actually believe that Muslims believe in a different God than non-Muslims, and this is part of the reason for it. But it gets better. Okay, for instance, you would never, another tool that I use to analyze sometimes is to try and rewrite the sentence as though Israel were the subject rather than Palestinians. So for instance, will you ever read in the New York Times a sentence that says this: Jews who have settled in the West Bank claim the whole of the British Mandate of Palestine as land granted by Yahweh, which cannot be ceded. You're not going to read that in the New York Times, but it's the precise equivalent, and it's also accurate to what I just read here. Okay, and then the sentence about the ceasefire. Now, that's a little more cunning in this case. The sentence about the ceasefire reveals even more Orientalist thinking. There are plenty of instances in world history of ceasefires, including in the recent Middle East, but the reporter is compelled to go back to the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century for his example. This is Orientalism 101. The implication is that Muslims and Arabs have an unchangeable essence, a core way of being, which is revealed in their ancient texts and in their history. Our reporter's sly insinuation is obvious. Nearly 1,300 years ago, the first Muslim, the Prophet Muhammad, offered his enemies a truce to restore his strength. Therefore, Hamas, who are also Muslims, are duplicitous by their very nature, and you cannot trust them. Just like Muhammad, once their strength is restored, they will stab you in the back. So this is all unstated, and yet this is the implication here. And I will have more examples. Okay, let's see. Let's move on. Okay, this is one that will come as no surprise to most of you. Use slanted language, but the point I'm making here is so often that people stop noticing. One of our bete noires at Mondo Weiss is settlements, the expression settlements. You know, by any stretch of the definition, these are colonies. These are people going into an area that was conquered militarily in the West Bank and putting people there who are not originally from that area. I'm not an international lawyer, but these are colonies. But we're so accustomed to hearing them called settlements that even people like us don't reflect on this possibly as much as we should. What we try and do sometimes at Mondo Weiss is write settlements / colonies or use both words interchangeably. I'll give you an example from history how this could be done. In the north of Ireland, Protestants tend to call the second largest city there Londonderry, and Catholics call it Derry. And what the BBC was faced with this problem of not showing bias back in the 70s, and so what they decided to do is they alternated. You know, the first reference in a BBC report would be Londonderry, and the next reference would be Derry, and the next reference would be Londonderry. Why can't we at least minimally start to do this? I'm not singling the Times out. Everybody does this with settlements. Now, one area in which the Times is a little more egregious is my second point, which is the business about the West Bank is disputed rather than occupied. And most media outlets, other media outlets, do say occupied, although occasionally they're even being backing away from that, too. But so the idea is disputed, you know, Israel disputes this. Meanwhile, 100 and X other countries believe that it is an occupied territory, and I don't think any international lawyer worth their salt denies this. But this is the kind of language that has become embedded in our thinking and our speaking. You know, Orwell's whole point about political language is that if you use certain languages, it prevents you from thinking in a different way, and I think here's an example of that. Okay. Here's one of my favorites, too. Conceal Israeli extremists. Okay, the slide's a little off here, but I'll get to that. Conceal Israeli extremists, settler colonists, and others, like the part that cut off there is Israeli Colonel Ofer Winter. Now, I learned about Ofer Winter from Max Blumenthal's excellent book, The 51-Day War, which is about the assault on Gaza, the Israeli assault on Gaza in 2014. In Winter, the top quote there is from Max. This colonel, who's well known in Israel, Ofer Winter is a household name there, he basically said that God had intervened to protect he and his soldiers when they were attacking Gaza. Godly intervention, we were protected by clouds of divine honor, Winter claimed. We, all the warriors, were suddenly covered by a heavy fog which came to us throughout the attack, preventing them from being shot and enabling them to carry out, I'm sure, were massacres for the most part. Okay. Here's my point. This is Colonel Winter. Any reporter who's beyond their first year of journalism school knows that Colonel Winter is the type of person you want to shoot over an interview and do a profile of him. I mean, this is the kind of guy. He's hysterical. He's a lunatic. He's representative of a portion of, and people will read the article. You have a chance to get on the front page if you do a profile of Ofer Winter, but you won't find him in the New York Times. I don't know that they sit, I'm not again saying there's a conspiracy. I don't think that they sit together and sort of say, well, let's cover up people like this. Another example is, though, the settler leaders in the West Bank, the colonist leaders in the West Bank. These people are often whitewashed or not reported on. I mean, Phil Weiss and I, you know, the comments section at Mondo Weiss occasionally gets comments from these settler colonists. You know, they want their point of view put across. So we actually, some years ago, we got in communication with one of them, and he published this manifesto, which was hair-raising. I mean, it really showed, they really want to kick every Palestinian out of the West Bank. That's what they want, okay? So it was hair-raising, so we wrote back to him and said, look, we would like to air your views. We would like to show people what you actually think. Can we reprint your whole manifesto? And he said, sure. You know, he was happy to have that because that's what he genuinely believes. So off it went, and we formed a little bit of a journalistic collaboration with him in a way. But the fact is that you don't see the New York Times reporters heading out to the West Bank to talk to these people, and yet they're part of the landscape of Israeli life. I mean, it's no secret. So, again, for the 10th time, I'm saying this is not a conspiracy, but I think these type of individuals make Israelis make reporters, Times reporters, uneasy, so they don't want to report on them. Okay. Here's another one. Quote Palestinians as little as possible. First, ignore Palestinians who live within Israel's 1967 borders, even though they are 20% of the population. This is a really offensive thing that the Times does. I mean, here's a fifth of the population, and you will rarely see them quoted in any articles. The implication is that all Israelis are Jews, except occasionally when the Druze start to have some protests, you might hear a little bit about them. But the implication is that, yeah, basically Israel is a Jewish state populated by all Jews. And imagine my surprise, even somebody relatively knowledgeable like I am, when the distinguished Palestinian-Israeli leader Ayman Odeh came to the United States a few years ago and went around, and some of you may have seen him giving various talks. And he was a very impressive man, totally nonviolent. His first place he went in the United States was to see the Dr. Martin Luther King's home area, the church in Atlanta. And here's a guy who will again be in the next Israeli Knesset, I believe, who politically represents a good fifth of the population, and yet, you know, he's only rarely quoted in the New York Times. You're never going to see him. Okay, and the second point is interview Palestinians in the, quote, disputed West Bank or Gaza only when it's absolutely necessary. And there are examples of that. There was a big piece on settlements that was done back in 2015 where, I do a lot of counting in my job. You know, how many paragraphs down is the real news? How many people from this side are quoted? How many people from that side? I'll just share you a little bit about this. This was a front page article, ran off the front page on settlements, quote, settlements in the West Bank. And it didn't quote a single Palestinian, not one. The article included maps, these are where the settlements are, this is this. Quotations from 11 different people, ranging from Benjamin Netanyahu down to an employee, a Jewish employee at a settlement, but not one Palestinian was asked for his reaction, not a single one. The only time Palestinians were even mentioned in this long article was one sentence that said, a Palestinian man grazed a few cows and sheep on a grassy hillside, and scores of teenagers in white Islamic headscarves walked home from school. But our reporters, it was two reporters, didn't stop to ask them any questions. You know, so as I went on to say, this short description is a masterpiece of Orientalist haiku. The Palestinians are only backward shepherds, nameless backward shepherds, and young women in headscarves, contrasted with the nearby boomtown, their quote, Israeli settlement. So, you know, they're erased from it. And then there was another element to this story. In this particular article, back during Netanyahu's first term as prime minister, he, quote, irked Washington in 1997 by adding 300 homes in Efrat, which is one of the settlements. Then I say, Netanyahu probably did more than irk the Palestinians who lost their land, but we won't learn it from this article. Our reporters did find that the settlements might cause human problems in the future. They warned that a peace agreement might eventually pose the challenge of someday uprooting Israelis who are now raising a second and third generation in contested areas. But somehow the two Times reporters could not find any Palestinians who are being uprooted today. So, okay. The next example, regularly published slanted pro-Israel articles. That's not worded properly. I think what I should have said was something along the lines of regularly published articles that are PR for Israel. And here's an example of one. This is a front page propaganda article about how Israel is doing desalinization, fighting drought, how successful it is. And then, as I said, part of my job involves counting. So it wasn't until the 23rd paragraph that Palestinians were even mentioned. Now, most of you, all of you, will be aware that water use by Israeli settler colonists, the aquifers are drying out. This is an issue, but you had to dig down into the 23rd paragraph to learn. And then here was the sentence that dealt with that. Struggles between Israel and its Arab neighbors over water rights in the Jordan River Basin contributed to tensions leading to the 1967 Middle East War. So, you know, but meanwhile, here's this big picture. You can see it up there on how well Israel is doing. You know, I haven't seen recently I haven't in years seen an article in the Times praising Israel for inventing the cherry tomato, but you know, at some stage that may actually end up happening as well. Okay, so that's, you know, I will say this, the current Times bureau chief there, he does not seem to do these kind of articles. His predecessor was more doing that. Okay, here's another one. Pay little attention to Israeli human rights organizations like Beit Selem or Breaking the Silence, and then ignore Palestinian human rights groups like Adalah. Okay, you know, here's an Israeli group. I mean, Beit Selem has both Palestinian Israelis and Jewish Israelis working for it. But, you know, I did some more counting, and it turned out that only rarely was this group mentioned. Now, you would think these would be one of the first groups of people you would go to. For instance, the Great March of Return a year ago, they were putting right on their website, Beit Selem was asking Israeli soldiers to not fire at civilians. They were pleading with them not fire. And they were out there monitoring what was actually going on. But no, there was no coverage of it in the Times. None. Okay. Okay. Boy, I'm only half through here, and my yellow light's on. Well, maybe I'll come back in a couple of years. And anyway, let's see. Let me continue. Okay. Okay, maybe I can finish up with this one. Oh, here's another one. I'm sure that many of you noticed this during the Great March of Return. Use the passive voice. Nobody does anything to anybody. Four Palestinians died in clashes. Clashes is another great vague word, you know. If I run out in the audience and smash four people in the head and they try and fight back a little bit, that could be described as a clash. But clearly that is, although technically and in a limited sense accurate, it's not what actually happened. So that's a good one. Instead of saying, as I said, you know, Israeli snipers killed four Palestinians. Now, there's nothing wrong with that sentence, Israeli snipers killed four Palestinians. Then if you want to get into the Israeli justification, we feared they were going to create, you know, print that. That's okay. But not this, four Palestinians died in clashes. Let's see, what do we got here? Oh, distort the timeline. This we saw a lot of, particularly during the Great March of Return. The lead, the first sentence in journalism, it's called the lead, was a violent act by Gazans. Gazans launched missiles, Gazans did this, Gazans did that. Bury the Israeli violent provocation several paragraphs down in the story. So you would go down like six or seven paragraphs, and then you would read that you know, Israeli commandos had raided into the southern part of Gaza and killed three people, and that the missiles were a response to that. So if you distort the timeline, you could make it seem like the Palestinians are the aggressors. This is a very common tactic that's used. Okay, here's another one. I'm not going to have time to get into this too much, but a new distortion technique which has emerged in the last year or two, several years, influenced by postmodernism. Dueling narratives. You know, the Israelis say this, the Palestinians say that. Who knows? The reader has to judge. Here's an example of it. There's Helbfinger there. He's the current bureau chief. So you can see his quote right toward the top in italics. For generations, both sides of the conflict have been locked in mutually competing negative narratives. The implicit so here's me now responding to that. The implicit question, who knows which side is right? This is postmodernism gone lethal, a view favored by Western liberals who sense something is terribly wrong but are too cowardly to criticize Israel. Sometimes one side of a dueling narrative is fundamentally true and the other is a pack of lies, which I think is true in this case. But if you set it up that way, you can evade what's really happening. Okay, here's another one. Take dictation from Israel, especially the Israeli military. Dwell on Israeli casualties and minimize Palestinian dead and wounded. This is a big one. Let's see if I get into it here. Oh, okay. Here, Helbfinger is listening to the current the Israeli military's current mouthpiece, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus. Before that, they had this guy, Peter Lerner, who we got into a debate with on Mondo Weiss. What they should do is ignore us, but occasionally they start to intervene and debate. We go back and forth, and that's good because we can show that they're listening. So Conricus, so listen, this is probably a little less than a year ago. Here's what he says here: seven paragraphs in a row, pom 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 pom. Conricus asserted the Gazans were planting or hurling explosives, flying flaming kites into Israel, trying to slip armed fighters to wreak havoc, launching an armed attack, firing numerous shots at Israeli soldiers. That was a lie, by the way. All of which amounted to unprecedented level of violence against Israel. Okay, next, stenographer Helpfinger, he's just writing what the Israeli official says, writes that Israel responded with gunfire and tear gas, and Israeli jets struck 5 targets in a Hamas military training facility. This is Orwellian. Lieutenant Colonel Conricus makes up or grossly exaggerates Gazan actions, and Helpfinger then calls Israel's vicious attacks a response to things that never happened. And then here's the final paragraph. This is the key in this whole thing here. He also says one Israeli soldier was wounded by shrapnel from what was believed to be an explosive device. Go down a little bit. This is me, not him, pointing out that at that stage, in nearly 7 weeks of the Great March of Protest, Israel had killed already 107 Palestinians and injured another 13,000, and this was going to be the first injury to any Israeli of any kind whatsoever. Okay. Let's see if I can race through the back here. Okay, I'm not going to probably have time. Okay, I'll just mention this quickly. The Times and Ahed Tamimi. You all know Ahed Tamimi as this brave young Palestinian woman who actually was in prison, 6, 9 months, whatever it was, for defending, okay. It was longer even than that. Okay, the Times had a problem with her because one of their magazine had included an article by Ben Ehrenreich, which was later part of his book, A Walk to the Spring, in which he actually went and stayed with the Tamimi family. He interviewed her, her father, her mother. He showed this courageous, nonviolent family of resistance. And so there was already in there. But so then when she became even more famous, the Times had to contradict its own coverage. I'm not going to have time to go into this, but, you know, I mean, I listed 20 different, not 20, but 10 different ways in which the article was distorted, including photographs of her, there were viral photographs of her at the time, and none of them ran with the Times story. Okay, so I'm going to have to skip by this. Okay. Quickly, in fairness, Times reporters do face an enormous amount of pressure from what we at Mondo Weiss call Hasbara Central, which is, the Israeli propaganda apparatus. We don't think it's literally one central office, although there is a central office that does a lot of this stuff. But the fact is that even now, even with the kind of protests that we do, the pressure that these reporters get from groups in the United States like Camera, which purport to monitor, and from within Israel itself, denying American reporters rights to interview certain people if they don't follow the rules and report in the way that they like. They still get more pressure from the other side than they do from our side. So, well, my response to that is too bad. If you don't like pressure, you shouldn't have become a reporter. Reporters are the type of people who sit in the back of the class, wait for the teacher, and the minute the teacher's done talking, stick up their hand and start attacking him with questions. That's how you can find who's going to be a good reporter. And if you don't want to do that, then don't get into it. But the fact is that this is a legitimate, this is what does happen. Let me give you an example here. Here's our friend Helpfinger. This is a tweet during the Great March of Return, where a pro-Israel guy up there, Sean Murray, says, why haven't you mentioned that a kite, here again, over 100 Palestinians have been shot dead already, and another thousands have been wounded. But he's objecting to, why isn't the Jerusalem bureau chief failed to mention the kite with an explosive device attached to it? And then Helpfinger immediately, stupidly, writes back and says, thanks for letting me know. That should have been in the piece hours ago. It will be soon. Now, I write to Helpfinger sometime. I write to him sometimes on Twitter. I tweet as JamesNorth7. I respond to him. He doesn't get back to me that quickly, I can tell you. But at any rate, okay, let me continue here. Okay, two suggestions. Larry Dorfner is a former, I would guess he would still call himself a liberal Zionist, but I don't really think he is anymore. His memoir here, No Country for Jewish Liberals, does include some explanations of how the press works in Israel. Larry's an American who moved to Israel and in his 50s basically turned against the system. You know, most people change when they're younger. It takes a lot of courage. So I recommend his book. And I also recommend this other book, which didn't get a lot of attention in the United States. Now, I hope there are no Dutch speakers here, because I'm not going to pronounce the author's last name properly, but it's Joris Levendijk, who wrote... Levendijk. Okay. Thank you. Well, he's a terrific reporter who came out with this book, I believe in 2010, 2011, somewhere in there. And... He came out with this book. Let me go back for here. He came out with this book. The first half is about his being a foreign correspondent in Egypt, which is interesting. But the second half is about Israel and how he covered Israel and the pressures that are on foreign reporters from the Israeli. I recommend it highly. It's still available online. Okay, we have found some signs of hope at the New York Times. Here's the article that many of you would have seen about the paramedic who was killed, in which the Israeli, the Times actually did an investigation, and even though it took him until about the fourth or fifth paragraph, they pointed out that this woman, when she was killed, it may have actually been a war crime, that she was shot by an Israeli sniper. Now, as I say right here, we found this article inconceivable. This came out the last day of 2018. We found that the Times wouldn't have even done this article as recently as 6 months or a year before that. And one example is there was a young Palestinian woman who was shot dead at a checkpoint near Hebron, Hashil al-Hamidun, who was shot dead like 3 years ago. Manda Weiss, we were able to find her family. They were able to talk to the press about what had happened. New York Times didn't bother to go find her. So this is a step in the right direction. What can we do? Let me just close with this. First of all, the Times does usually not allow comments on its news articles, particularly from Israel-Palestine. So if you want to comment, you know, no chance. However, they often allow comments on their editorial. Now, I haven't gotten into the editorial policy here because I was confined myself strictly to news. They haven't gotten into it, but they do allow comments, and I encourage people to go in and comment, because you will be surprised, you may be surprised, at the level of understanding and criticism that there is growing in the American public about what's really going on in Israel-Palestine. I mean, we're heartened by it and surprised by it. So, you know, if you're a Times subscriber, you can sign up and comment. And they do tend to run a lot of these comments. The second point I make is to visit Twitter and social media, challenge and comment there. This is particularly common among young people. You know, even everybody sees it now. You know, it's not just me talking to you in this room. I go into line later, and people come and read down through the various tweets and so on and so forth. And the reporters have to, first of all, the reporters are subject to, you know, they're a little uneasy. You know, I think deep down they know that they're not doing an excellent job. They're uneasy. But more importantly is that the audience sees this. There's a challenge. It's not just running in a newspaper with no response to it. And the final point I make is that, obviously, to continue the type of solidarity work that probably all of you are involved in, because the best guarantee of increased coverage, I mean, it sounds like putting the cart before the horse, but the best guarantee is that the public demands better coverage. If the public knows what it's missing, or at least senses what it's missing and demands more of it, then the newspaper, the Times, is going to have to respond. And I think that's it. So I hope, sorry I didn't go on too long, and I appreciate you listening. Thank you. That wasn't too bad.
Thank you very much. We're running up against lunch here. But if you could just answer one question.
There we go. We're running up against lunch, but if you can answer one question, just because
sure.
Two people have asked it.
I apologize for rattling on too long.
Two people are curious how or if the coverage in the Times has changed since A.G. Sulzberger took over as publisher.
Well, as I said, there was that sign, that article that appeared right at the end of last year. Whether that's connected to the new publisher or not, I really don't know. I used to have a source who worked in the editorial department, which is entirely separate, okay? I mean, they say hello to each other, but they don't quote. And he said that it was understood back then that you had to be very careful if you proposed editorials about Israel-Palestine, that you, you know, it was known that it could be a problem for your career. Now, as far as the news section, you know, Phil and I have been trying to get, see if anyone from the Times wants to speak to us off the record or behind the scenes. So far, we haven't been able to. But as to how, you know, as to whether it comes from the publisher, I really wouldn't know. Yeah.
I thought it was just worthwhile to share this comment and someone share it that, despite all the evidence that you just presented, how many avid supporters of Israel still regularly claim that, you know, the mainstream media is biased against Israel. You hear it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I thought that was just worth throwing out there. Anyway, so right now we're going to break for lunch, which will be served over there. If anyone is in need of divine mercy right now, we have prayers at 12:45 in the winner's room, if anyone would like that. And make sure to be here promptly at 1:15 for Susan Abulhawa's keynote address, which you're not going to want to miss.
No.
Thank you. And the Deer's Fair will be open as well. Thank you.
All right.